A Profex felsőfokú nyelvvizsga első vizsgaszövegét fogja hallani. Kérem, olvass el a feladatlapot, erre 1 perc áll rendelkezésére. Most kétszer egymás után fogja hallani a szöveget. A két szöveg elhangzása között 30 másodperc szünetet tartunk. A második meghallgatás után 2 perc áll rendelkezésére a feladatlap kitöltésére.
Uterine fibroids. Uterine fibroids, leiomyomas or myomas, are extremely common benign neoplasms of the uterus. The lifetime prevalence of fibroids exceeds 80% among black women and approaches 70% among white women. In a study using ultrasonographic screening, 51% of premenopausal women received a new diagnosis of fibroids. Fibroids can cause heavy or prolonged menstrual bleeding and result in anemia in women of reproductive age. Fibroid-related bleeding can also occur in postmenopausal women, but bleeding in this population should prompt evaluation for more worrisome causes of the symptom, including endometrial hyperplasia and carcinoma. Large fibroids in a enlarged uterus can also result in bulk symptoms, including bowel and bladder dysfunction and abdominal protrusion. Painful menses, non-cyclic pelvic pain, infertility, and recurrent miscarriage can also be symptoms of fibroids, but many fibroids remain asymptomatic. In women with symptomatic fibroids, heavy menstrual bleeding resolves at menopause, and most women with symptoms related to leiomyoma bulk will have some fibroid shrinkage and symptom relief after this time. Increasing age up to menopause in black race are the major risk factors for fibroids. The rate of hospitalization in which fibroid is a discharge diagnosis is approximately 3 times as high, and the rate of uterine-sparing myomectomy, surgical removal of fibroids, is nearly 7 times as high among black women as among white women. Black women also report significantly more severe fibroid symptoms and more impairment of daily activities. Both reproductive and environmental factors influence the risk of fibroids. Increasing parity is associated with a decreased risk, possibly through elimination of incipient fibroids as the uterus involutes postpartum. Early menarche and the use of oral contraceptives before 16 years of age are associated with an increased risk, whereas the use of progestin-only injectable contraceptives is associated with a reduced risk. Observational data suggest that dietary factors, including increased consumption of fruit, vegetables, and low-fat dairy products, are associated with a reduced risk. Some studies have shown that a high body mass index is a risk factor. Specific genetic mutations have also been linked to fibroid formation. Uterine fibroids are often suspected in a premenopausal woman when an enlarged uterus or a mass is palpated during a pelvic examination or when she reports heavy menstrual bleeding. Ultrasonography is the standard confirmatory test because it can easily and inexpensively differentiate a fibroid from a pregnant uterus or an adnexal mass. The need for further imaging depends on the clinical findings in the patient. In women with heavy menstrual bleeding, ultrasonographic examination after the infusion of saline into the endometrial cavity can identify the extent of intracavitary fibroids. In women with heavy menstrual bleeding, the severity of bleeding, its potential consequences, and causes other than fibroids should be assessed. Testing in these patients should include a complete blood count and screening for thyroid dysfunction. Selected screening may include evaluation for coagulation disorders, especially von Willebrand's disease, if heavy bleeding dates to menarche or if the patient has a pertinent personal or family history, and an endometrial biopsy if irregular bleeding occurs or the patient has risk factors for endometrial hyperplasia, obesity, chronic anovulation, or the use of estrogen without progestin therapy. Uterine fibroids. Uterine fibroids, leiomyomas or myomas, are extremely common benign neoplasms of the uterus. The lifetime prevalence of fibroids exceeds 80% among black women and approaches 70% among white women. In a study using ultrasonographic screening, 51% of premenopausal women received a new diagnosis of fibroids. Fibroids can cause heavy or prolonged menstrual bleeding and result in anemia in women of reproductive age. Fibroid-related bleeding can also occur in postmenopausal women, but bleeding in this population should prompt evaluation for more worrisome causes of the symptom, including endometrial hyperplasia and carcinoma. Large fibroids in an enlarged uterus can also result in bulk symptoms, including bowel and bladder dysfunction and abdominal protrusion. Painful menses, non-cyclic pelvic pain, infertility, and recurrent miscarriage can also be symptoms of fibroids, but many fibroids remain asymptomatic. In women with symptomatic fibroids, heavy menstrual bleeding resolves at menopause, and most women with symptoms related to leiomyoma bulk will have some fibroid shrinkage and symptom relief after this time. Increasing age up to menopause and black race are the major risk factors for fibroids. The rate of hospitalization in which fibroid is a discharge diagnosis is approximately 3 times as high, and the rate of uterine-sparing myomectomy, surgical removal of fibroids, is nearly 7 times as high among black women as among white women. Black women also report significantly more severe fibroid symptoms and more impairment of daily activities. Both reproductive and environmental factors influence the risk of fibroids. Increasing parity is associated with a decreased risk, possibly through elimination of incipient fibroids as the uterus involutes postpartum. Early menarche and the use of oral contraceptives before 16 years of age are associated with an increased risk, whereas the use of progestin-only injectable contraceptives is associated with a reduced risk. Observational data suggest that dietary factors, including increased consumption of fruit, vegetables, and low-fat dairy products, are associated with a reduced risk. Some studies have shown that a high body mass index is a risk factor. Specific genetic mutations have also been linked to fibroid formation. Uterine fibroids are often suspected in a premenopausal woman when an enlarged uterus or a mass is palpated during a pelvic examination or when she reports heavy menstrual bleeding. Ultrasonography is the standard confirmatory test because it can easily and inexpensively differentiate a fibroid from a pregnant uterus or an adnexal mass. The need for further imaging depends on the clinical findings in the patient. In women with heavy menstrual bleeding, ultrasonographic examination after the infusion of saline into the endometrial cavity can identify the extent of intracavitary fibroids. In women with heavy menstrual bleeding, the severity of bleeding, its potential consequences, and causes other than fibroids should be assessed. Testing in these patients should include a complete blood count and screening for thyroid dysfunction. Selected screening may include evaluation for coagulation disorders, especially von Willebrand's disease, if heavy bleeding dates to menarche or if the patient has a pertinent personal or family history, and an endometrial biopsy if irregular bleeding occurs or the patient has risk factors for endometrial hyperplasia, obesity, chronic anovulation, or the use of estrogen without progestin therapy.
A PROFEX felsőfokú nyelvvizsga második vizsgaszövegét fogja hallani. Kérem, olvass el a feladatlapot, erre 1 perc áll rendelkezésére. Most kétszer egymás után fogja hallani a szöveget. A két szöveg elhangzása között 30 másodperc szünetet tartunk. A második meghallgatás után 2 perc áll rendelkezésére, a feladatlap kitöltésére.
We have to take a few minutes then and explain what this is. So my image of a hearing aid is it's like putting a loudspeaker in your ear to amplify things, but a cochlear implant works differently, and I know I first saw them, some 20-odd years ago. What is the principle of how a cochlear implant works? Because I know it's very different than a hearing aid.
Well, first of all, we have to understand why people get to this point. There are different types of hearing loss that we see, and the hearing loss that we address with a cochlear implant is commonly what people call nerve deafness. And in reality, what is happening in the vast majority of these people is that it's not the nerve actually, it's the inner ear, what we call the cochlea, the organ that we hear with. Inside, there are tiny little cells that basically have little hairs on them that create the signal. The electrical signal due to the sound vibrations that our brain eventually interprets, and that's how we hear. So, as a person loses their hearing, those little hair cells deteriorate. And there are numerous reasons for that, whether it's... There are genetics, you know, Patrick has a family history. Whether it's from medications or from infections, there are lots of reasons. And you'll get to a certain point where if the population of those cells gets very small, that a hearing aid won't work. And what you'll find in a lot of these people is that sometimes they'll be able to hear, but they'll complain to you that they don't understand. So you can make things very loud, but they still hear noise, or they still hear distortion. So what the implant actually does is that the electrode, or this wire, that we actually insert into the turns of the cochlea at the time of the surgery, has basically little electrode contacts. And what the audiologist is able to do is program the amount of current, basically, that is passing through the electrodes. So these electrodes that we're inserting are actually replacing the hair cells and stimulating the nerve like the hair cells are supposed to. So we're bypassing the damaged cochlea and stimulating it on from there. So that's a big difference than a hearing aid, because not only are we able, in a lot of patients, to improve the level at which they hear, but more importantly, we are able to increase the amount that they understand. So they're able to understand more and more words. Well, the early devices that were actually single channels were available in the 1980s, and actually even earlier than that. I mean, the original idea that we could actually hear an electrical stimulation was discovered in the 1950s. So as far as having multi-channel devices around, meaning implants that have more than one electrical contact, as Patrick stated, we started seeing this in the early 90s. So these devices have been available now for a good 16, 18 years. They have improved. The design of the electrodes has improved. The design of the actual piece we insert, the way the contacts are actually stimulated, so things did change. The other thing where most of the improvements we see are actually in the speech processing. So after the implant is inserted, the patient wears an external portion that we call a speech processor that actually has the microphone in it. It processes the sound, and that signal is transmitted through the skin. So the internal piece we insert has a magnet, and the headpiece has a magnet, and they couple, and the information is sent through the skin into the electrode to stimulate that. So a lot of the improvements that we see are in the processing, so basically in the software engineering of these implants.
We have to take a few minutes then and explain what this is. So my image of a hearing aid is it's like putting a loudspeaker in your ear to amplify things, but a cochlear implant works differently, and I know I first saw them, some 20-odd years ago. What is the principle of how a cochlear implant works? Because I know it's very different than a hearing aid.
Well, first of all, we have to understand why people get to this point. There are different types of hearing loss that we see, and the hearing loss that we address with a cochlear implant is commonly what people call nerve deafness. And in reality, what is happening in the vast majority of these people is that it's not the nerve actually, it's the inner ear, what we call the cochlea, the organ that we hear with. Inside, there are tiny little cells that basically have little hairs on them that create the signal. The electrical signal due to the sound vibrations that our brain eventually interprets, and that's how we hear. So, as a person loses their hearing, those little hair cells deteriorate. And there are numerous reasons for that, whether it's... there are genetics, you know, Patrick has a family history. Whether it's from medications or from infections, there are lots of reasons. And you'll get to a certain point where if the population of those cells gets very small, that a hearing aid won't work. And what you'll find in a lot of these people is that sometimes they'll be able to hear, but they'll complain to you that they don't understand. So you can make things very loud, but they still hear noise, or they still hear distortion. So what the implant actually does is that the electrode, or this wire, that we actually insert into the turns of the cochlea at the time of the surgery, has basically little electrode contacts. And what the audiologist is able to do is program the amount of current, basically, that is passing through the electrodes. So these electrodes that we're inserting are actually replacing the hair cells and stimulating the nerve like the hair cells are supposed to. So we're bypassing the damaged cochlea and stimulating it on from there. So that's a big difference than a hearing aid, because not only are we able, in a lot of patients, to improve the level at which they hear, but more importantly, we are able to increase the amount that they understand. So they're able to understand more and more words. Well, the early devices that were actually single channels were available in the 1980s, and actually even earlier than that. I mean, the original idea that we could actually hear an electrical stimulation was discovered in the 1950s. So as far as having multi-channel devices around, meaning implants that have more than one electrical contact, as Patrick stated, we started seeing this in the early 90s. So these devices have been available now for a good 16, 18 years. They have improved. The design of the electrodes has improved. The design of the actual piece we insert, the way the contacts are actually stimulated. So things did change. The other thing where most of the improvements we see are actually in the speech processing. So after the implant is inserted, the patient wears an external portion that we call a speech processor that actually has the microphone in it. It processes the sound, and that signal is transmitted through the skin. So the internal piece we insert has a magnet, and the headpiece has a magnet, and they couple, and the information is sent through the skin into the electrode to stimulate that. So a lot of the improvements that we see are in the processing, so basically in the software engineering of these implants.